It is Monday, the 5th of March, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. Ahead on the show today, we speak with filmmaker Ian Cheney about The City Dark, his documentary about light pollution. Also on the show today, a preview of the Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week that starts tonight, and a conversation with author Gary B. A.G. regarding his book on Daniel Rudd, the founder of National Black Catholic Congress. KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. The museum opens at 11 a.m. daily except Tuesdays. More information is available online at crystalbridges.org. But first, as a former Peace Corps volunteer stationed in the African country of Mali, Kurt Baker says this is the most interesting thing that happened to him.
The only way in and out of my village was on a train. This ramshackle, wobbly train that very often broke down or jumped off the tracks. So there was always excitement involved with a train ride in and out of my village. And I can remember very early on in my service being so jam-packed in there. The only space I could find was somewhat in between two cars, and I can just remember it was night, and I was leaving my village going to the town, and I can remember just looking up and seeing the stars, and you know, just thinking, wow, like I'm here, I'm in Africa, I'm on my own, this is my first real job, and I just had that experience where, all right, I'm doing this.
Baker now works as a recruiter for Peace Corps, an organization that was founded in 1961 and currently employs over 9,000 volunteers in 76 countries across the world. He visited the University of Arkansas campus last week from Dallas to recruit volunteers. During his visit, Baker came by KUAF's Harold and Blanche Cock News Studio to talk with me about the opportunities available for anyone who's interested in promoting world peace and friendship.
Well, we are a government agency, and we send volunteers overseas to work in one of 75-plus countries in a variety of different skill areas, ranging from education to agriculture, environment, business development, health and youth and community development. And based on someone's major or work or volunteer experience, we'll place them in one of those countries.
Now, right before we started our interview, you told me that you served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali for 2 years. Tell us something about your experiences.
Sure. Well, I was in the business sector based on my major in finance, and so I was assigned to work in Mali in West Africa. I had never really heard of it or knew much about it, and I was there from 2003 to 2005.
Okay.
And my main assignment was working with women's groups to help them start small projects. So I was doing microfinance, and they would typically do projects like dyeing cloth, making fabric, or making soap. And I did a lot of other side projects, or secondary projects as we call them in Peace Corps, with HIV/AIDS education in schools and talking on the radio. And I did some projects with the Association of Gardeners in my village. So it's always important for Peace Corps volunteers to be flexible, to work outside of their expertise, if you will, and basically be a volunteer for the entire community.
What does it take to be a Peace Corps volunteer?
Well, as far as the application process goes, or what we're looking for in an applicant, we do look for specific degrees or work or volunteer experience, good GPAs. We're looking for people that are just motivated and willing to work under conditions of hardship if need be, in rural locations if need be, anybody that's willing to tackle the cultural barriers and language barriers that come with working in Peace Corps. So I think the ideal Peace Corps volunteer is just a motivated individual who is looking to change their perspective on life, because that certainly will come from 2 years of service in a developing country.
So how does it work, the application process?
Our website is peacecorps.gov, and that's where you would apply. There's a ton of information from videos and other information that helps people learn about Peace Corps. We're all over Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, all those things. It's really cool to read volunteer blogs and look at pictures they've posted and videos of their site. But the application is all online. It's a fairly lengthy process. It can take up to 12 months. And so we tell people to apply 12 months before they would like to go overseas.
What do you learn when you're volunteering with Peace Corps?
You learn who you are. You gain a new perspective on life. You see kind of how the rest of the world lives outside of, you know, the bubble that we most likely grew up in here in the States, at least. You come away with a sense of strength that you can accomplish anything. There's not going to be much harder than 2 years of Peace Corps. So knowing that you have accomplished that, I feel like I can tackle anything now.
Where can people find more information about the recruitment process?
Well, here in this area, if you're listening in Arkansas, then your recruitment office will be located in Dallas, and I'm the current recruiter for this area. So you can find us on peacecorps.gov. You can find your local recruiting office there. I'll come to Arkansas probably twice per school semester, and perhaps once in the summer. I'll go to Little Rock, and I'll spend time here at Northwest Arkansas as well. And we post recruitment events online. So once you're there to peacecorps.gov, you can click on connect with a recruiter, and you can search by state and by area. So that's where you'll find recruiting events that I'm hosting.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kurt.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Kurt Baker is a returned volunteer and recruiter for Peace Corps. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar. Daniel Rudd may not be a household name when it comes to 19th century history, but he lived an intriguing and influential life. Daniel Rudd was born a slave in Kentucky, but as a young man, he founded and edited one of the most successful African-American-owned newspapers of his time. His story is recounted in the new book, A Cry for Justice, Daniel Rudd and His Life in Black Catholicism, Journalism and Activism, 1854 to 1933, by Gary B. A.G. and published by the University of Arkansas Press. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently talked to the author about the amazing life of Daniel Rudd.
He was born a slave in Bardstown, as you say, a very Catholic area in Kentucky. And as far as we know, the Jesuits who were there worked with him and helped him with his education. Rudd spoke fluent German and wrote German. So, I mean, he was obviously a very sharp young man, and maybe the Jesuits worked with him there. But also he moved to Springfield sometime before 1876. Now I'm talking about Springfield, Ohio.
Right.
And there he worked, finished his education there and worked at a hotel there and did some other odd jobs, some mechanic work, we think. But then he started working in the newspaper business. He worked with the Springfield Review. You know, and I think that anybody that was really interested in civil rights for African Americans, I mean, lots of folks anyway, they went into the publishing business and, you know, wrote and editorialized about the things that they were facing. In fact, there were more African-American newspapers started, you know, from that period of history right after the end of Radical Reconstruction up to, you know, 1915 or so, when, you know, Jim Crow was really set in the South. There were more African-American newspapers started during that period of time than any other period of publishing history.
Yeah, you write that more than 50% of all African-American-owned newspapers since 1827 were in that post-Reconstruction era from the late 1870s to about 12 or 15 years into the 20th century.
Yeah, really, I don't think there's a mystery for that. You know, when we think about, what was happening with regard to the rights of African Americans during that period. You have to remember that, you know, they were losing rights that they had really gained after the Civil War, at the end of the Civil War, and during the early period of Reconstruction. And so, you know, as the separate coach laws were being passed, and of course, I think the first separate coach law was passed in Arkansas in 1891. And that's about the time that Rudd was really hitting his stride, talking about the rights of African Americans. And, you know, of course, more separate coach or Jim Crow laws, rather, were passed in Arkansas, say, in 1903. So also, I mean, if you look at just Arkansas history, from 1889 to 1918, there were 214 lynchings in the state, and about 85% of that, of those lynchings were of African Americans.
He, as you mentioned, in Bairdstown, Kentucky, Jesuits raised there, believed, educated early. He saw the Catholic Church as perhaps not just an agent, but the agent to solve racism in the United States.
Well, you're correct about that. During the period of the publication of the American Catholic Tribune, he very much trumpeted the merits of Catholicism for African Americans. And he really believed that the Catholic Church was the answer. Really twofold. There's a twofold reason for this. First of all, he believed when blacks were converted and came into the church, they would be treated as brothers, not second-class citizens. And secondly, he believed in something we call the Romantic apologetic for Catholicism, which was really this idea that, you know, the Catholic Church would lead the way in civilizing secular society by teaching society the way they ought to behave toward African Americans outside the walls of the Catholic Church. So it's really sort of a twofold reason that he trumpeted the merits of Catholicism for blacks.
And you write that at least at one point, perhaps the American Catholic Tribune, it was an African American newspaper designed perhaps primarily for African American audiences, but at least at one point it perhaps had a larger readership among white Catholics than African Americans.
Yeah, you know, we're speculating here, but,
right. You
know, he was selling an awful lot of subscriptions to whites as well as African-Americans. And so he would visit parishes, and he would speak and sell subscriptions. And he spoke to a lot of, well, white Catholics. And so we think that, I mean, it had a dual readership, and maybe more whites than blacks. I think Joseph Lackner may have said that, may have written that, there were more white readers than blacks.
How easy is it to try to define what the American Catholic Church attitude towards race in the 19th century was?
Well, it's certainly a mixed bag. You had some in the Catholic Church that were working really hard on behalf of African Americans, and yet they were infected with this sort of patronizing spirit. They believed that, you know, the African Americans were sort of part of a developing race, those kind of things. I think of John Slattery and the American Josephites. Well, you know, they were working to raise up black priests, but there was this strong feeling that, you know, it might take a while. They really couldn't get the academic piece to it, and, you know, could they really be celibate? Could African Americans be celibate? Were they capable of this? So there's this real patronizing spirit. But then also, you had Catholics that were, I mean, they were wonderful advocates on behalf of blacks, including John Ireland, Archbishop of St. Paul, Minnesota. And, you know, he really comes off looking good in the book because he did some amazing things on behalf of African Americans.
He delivers this, at the time, controversial sermon that, you know, read with the hindsight of history is, my goodness, what a progressive attitude he had at the time, where he was not just arguing but saying there is no other choice. We have to all be equal. In fact, said there is no, as the terminology of the time said, Negro problem. That's not the problem. The problem is in the minds of people who insist on seeing that problem.
You know, it was a beautiful sermon. I think you're referring, I think it was May 5th, 1890, when Ireland spoke to a packed house at St. Augustine Parish in Washington, D.C. And I tell you, when I read that, it sent chills up my spine. And, I mean, he really was progressive. I think he said something like, in 50 years, we'll wonder why there ever was race prejudice. And so he said, I'll recognize no color line. And really, his sermon caused quite a stir. Even progressives in the Catholic Church thought he'd gone too far. And so, wasn't that great? I mean, it was a fantastic sermon. It was great reading.
Well, and some of the criticisms of that sermon that were offered in newspaper rebuttals were that he was calling for, this phrase, too much equality.
Right, and so that gets back to the idea of sort of it's a mixed bag.
Right.
Ed, you really did have bigoted Catholics in the church who really criticized and roundly criticized Ireland and others who were, you know, from Ireland's camp. And they said some pretty cruel things about African Americans. And so Red wasn't stupid, and he wasn't naive. He knew that there was this element in the Catholic Church. But Rudd was an optimist, and Rudd really tried to say things like, well, if there are bigoted Catholics in the Church, they didn't learn it from the leaders in the Catholic Church, and they didn't learn it from their teaching. He didn't implicate the Catholic Church. But he said these were sort of rogue elements that needed to straighten themselves out, really, if you want to say it that way.
Gary B. Agee is an adjunct professor of church history at Anderson School of Theology, Anderson University. He is the author of the new book, A Cry for Justice, Daniel Rudd and His Life in Black Catholicism, Journalism, and Activism, 1854 to 1933, published by the University of Arkansas Press. In a few minutes, we'll hear more about rock musician, actor, and Arkansas native Levon Helm on Arkansongs. But first, fashion enthusiasts in Northwest Arkansas can now look forward to a fashion week they can call their own. The Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week has been put together by local designers and boutiques committed to not only highlighting fashion in the region, but also making a difference in the community. Ozarks at Large's Katie Hendrickson has this story.
We may be far away from New York City, so it's hard to get to New York Fashion Week, but Northwest Arkansas has its own now in Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week, which starts tonight and runs through Saturday. Melissa Ahrens, co-owner of Mayapple Salon and fashion director of the nonprofit arts organization Artemis, stopped by the KUAF studios to talk about her role in the Fashion Week. What is Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week?
Well, it's a collaboration of the people that have been throwing fashion shows within the past 10 years in the community already, kind of got together. Jay Terminella from Lola, she does Strut for a Mutt. She founded the thing, her and Danielle Vaughn. And she just kind of brought everybody together that had already been producing fashion shows in the area and just made a collaboration of all of the shows. Kind of bringing everyone together, the main purpose, but to have it all in one week like, you know, New York does with Fashion Week. So,
and I grew up in Fayetteville, and when I was younger, there weren't all these boutiques, local designers, all this fashion stuff going on. What happened? Like,
it is pretty wild. Since I've been involved in the hair industry and since I've been involved with Artemis, probably been about the past 5 years more heavily, I've noticed the fashion scene, like, double or triple in the past 2 years. So there were just like a couple of fashion shows that would go on, you know, local things. And then I've literally seen it just double. I think, you know, people catch on to something that's fun and cool and happening, and then they do it too. So it's definitely doubled in the past 2 years. And I think that was a lot of what gave Jade the idea to kind of put it all together in one, because there's only so many models in the area. There's only so many local designers in the area. And it was, you know, everything was overlapping and reshowing. So I think putting it all together kind of makes that a little bit easier to. I've been involved with Artemis for the past 5 years or so, just kind of on the side. And then for the past year, I've been the actual fashion director, which means I throw fashion-related events. And so basically, I'm a hairstylist, makeup artist, co-owner of Mayapple Salon and Boutique, but then I'm also fashion director for Artemis. So those kind of overlap and intertwine because we carry a lot of local designers' things in our shop. And then I also use their things to show in the Artemis fashion shows. So my segment of Fashion Week is Thursday evening. We're the headlining show for that night, and we have several different local designers that are just amazing. And I put the show together and kind of coordinate it, but then I also do hair and makeup for several of the models, and I do some of the styling as well. I even have about 5 girls that are helping me, though. So there's 45 models, 45 different looks within our segment even, so...
The night of when it's all happening, describe like what you'll be doing while the models are coming down the runway and everything.
So we will probably get started about 2 o'clock. So first they're set up. You have to set everything up. So we'll set everything up, hair and makeup, clothing, you know, bringing in racks of clothing and stuff. So you start pretty early with all of that. Then once you get everything set up, you have to have a schedule of all the models coming in for styling, hairstyling, and makeup. So they start to kind of flow in, I think, around 2 o'clock, and we're just basically working from 2 till the show starts at 9:30, just getting everybody, you know, perfected. And then once the show, right before the show, about 30 minutes before the show, you kind of do touch-ups and last-minute, you know, things with their clothing. And then they walk, and the show's over in, like, 10 minutes.
It all happens so quickly.
Exactly, yeah.
All that preparation and everything. Talk about how you see fashion as an art form.
I've always seen fashion as art, and so it's been just such a great opportunity to become the fashion director for Artemis, because I think that hair and makeup can kind of be seen as almost like a frou-frou kind of thing, you know? And so getting an opportunity to express myself with hair and makeup and kind of have people view it more as art has been really great. I think that just like with local designers and stylists as well, you kind of just get an opportunity to express your inner, you know, beliefs even, and just ideas and stuff through hair and makeup and clothing. And it's definitely a self-expression.
Those interested in attending Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week have a lot of different options.
You can go to nwafw.com, NorthwestArkansasFashionWeek.com, and you can purchase tickets for that's actually broken up until evening. So there's Wednesday night is shop local, and you actually don't purchase tickets for that. You can show up, and I think it's a $5 cover, or you can bring a non-perishable canned food item and get in to Wednesday night. So that's shop local night. And then there's Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night. So when you go to nwafw.com, you can purchase tickets for Thursday, Friday, or Saturday by clicking on those days. And you can also choose which charity you want to benefit. So there's a list of all the charities that are involved.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Melissa Ahrens, Fashion Director of Artemis and co-owner of Mayapple Salon and Boutique. She is a stylist participating in this week's Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week. It kicks off tonight with a shopping night out, which will have specials at participating boutiques from 5 to 9 p.m. And if you'd like more information on Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week, just go to nwafw.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
This is Ozarks at Large for the 5th of March 2012. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar, and with me is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, we have two wildly diverse things for tonight.
Okay.
At 7 o'clock, you can go to auditions for a play called Other People's Money at Fort Smith Little Theater. Or you can go to the Gardner Building Lecture Hall at the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith for a lecture called The End of the Oil Age.
I did a story with Dr. Eric Baker.
So that would be a really interesting lecture to hear.
It will be.
And it's free.
That's always a plus. Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Levon Helm was born in Elaine and grew up in Turkey Scratch in Phillips County. Helm went on to become known as the drummer and vocalist of the band, as well as for his solo and acting careers. And while Helm and the band had their own popular successes, they especially enjoyed critical acclaim and the high regard of fellow artists. Evidence of the latter is clear in the musical tributes to Levon Helm alone. Elton John's 1971 hit single, Levon, still a staple of classic rock radio, was written by the flamboyant singer and piano man with his longtime writing collaborator, Bernie Taupin. The song appears on Elton John's landmark album, Mad Man Across the Water, and was inspired by Arkansas-er Levon Helm because of the duo's high regard for the band's 1968 debut, Music from Big Pink. This is verified by the album's producer, Gus Dudgeon, who, according to Cecil Adams' Straight Dope column, says the band was apparently a favorite of Taupin and John during the period in which Madman Across the Water was written. The Rose Hotel is the 15th studio release from stalwart Texas singer-songwriter Robert Earl Keen. References to Arkansas are easy to come by in Keen's recordings. This release even features a duet of sorts with Malvern-born actor and musician Billy Bob Thornton. But the highlight of this 2009 record comes with Keen and his longtime bass player Bill Whitbeck paying homage to Levon Helm with the song Man Behind the Drums. The song was inspired by a trip the pair took to one of Levon Helm's Midnight Ramble concerts in September 2008.
Son of a plain dirt farmer from southeast Arkansas. He was born in a pair of rambling shoes.
Keen and Whitbeck were the show's opening act. They ended up hanging around and joined Levon Helm on the band's song The Wait to close the show. An experience echoed in the lyrics, Up There in the Spotlight, the man behind the drums was taking all the load off for you and me.
There in the spotlight, the man behind the drums was taking all the load off you and me. Levon takes the doghouse, playing in the band. When he locks into that backbeat, it ain't hard to understand. Get your body moving, celebrate your soul.
In 2007, Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Mark Cohn released Join the Parade, which features a musical tribute to Levon Helm called Listening to Levon as its opener.
Listening to Levon is the opening track. You know, it talks about a young man who's got his girlfriend in his father's car. This great sound comes out on the radio, and all of a sudden, he doesn't know the girl is there anymore. One of the people for me that was huge like that was Levon Helm.
It's the first song on the first studio album released by Mark Cohn after he survived being shot in the head. Levon Helm's daughter, Amy, even contributes background vocals to the album. In 2012, Helm won his third individual Grammy Award in 4 years, and, including the band's Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 2008, his fourth overall in 4 years. Arkansas-er Levon Helm has continued to inspire well into more than a half century of being in the public eye. Here in its entirety is Mark Cohn and his song, Listening to Levon, about Levon Helm from Turkey Scratch in Phillips County in eastern Arkansas.
I was sitting with Mary in my dad's blue Valiant. Rain was coming down and the radio was playing. And Mary was talking a million miles a minute. I could not hear one word she was saying. I was lost, I was gone, listening to Levon. In another world, oh, in another place. I was lost, I was gone, listening to Levon. I was looking in Mary's eyes, but I was listening to Levon. Oh yeah. Mary's hair was black, that much I remember.
Mary's skin was smooth, I remember that too. And she'd open her eyes. Sometimes when she kissed me, I don't know why she did that. Maybe Mary knew. I was lost, I was gone, listening and leave on in another place, oh, in some other world. Yeah, I was lost, I was gone, listening and leave on. I was looking at the girl, but I was listening and leave on. To protect the innocent, I might have even lied about the car. But this is just to say, I'm sorry if I hurt you, but Mary, if you're out there, you know who you are. Sorry, babe. Serves me right, if you can't even hear me singing. If you tuned me out a long time ago, and it served me right, if you already changed the station and you're listening right now to that old boy on the radio, radio, and you're lost. And you're gone, listening to me gone in another world, oh, from some other place. Are you lost? Are you gone? Listening to me gone. Is there a smile upon your face while you're listening to me gone?
Grammy winner Mark Cohn in his 2007 song, Listening to Levon, written about Arkansas-er Levon Helm from Turkey Scratch in Phillips County. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar. Remember catching fireflies in a jar or looking at the night sky and counting stars? Most of us don't do those things anymore, but if we did, we'd have to look quite a bit to find fireflies and stars. As city lights are getting brighter, twinkling of the stars is getting fainter. Last week, I spoke with documentary filmmaker Ian Chaney, whose documentary The City Dark, soon to be screened on the University of Arkansas campus, discusses the issue of light pollution.
The twinkling of cities at night always says to me, look at us as a species. This is what we do.
What's happened over my lifetime is that you have a kind of a sprawl. City lights spilling out into the surrounding regions. Our society is kind of taking over the wilderness, but it's happening slowly and no one really notices it.
A trailer for the documentary The City Dark captures a night sky lover's worries and dilemmas. The documentary's maker, Ian Cheney, grew up in rural Maine, where he fell in love with the night sky. But the relationship faded when he moved to a city. It was then that Cheney decided to explore the loss of night sky and how it affects city dwellers.
In a way, light pollution probably ought to be called night pollution, because it's really the pollution of the darkness and of natural nighttime with excessive artificial light, which really wasn't a problem 150 years ago. But as lighting technologies have allowed us to create brighter and brighter lights, and as populations and cities have grown and commerce has expanded, our world has gotten measurably brighter as seen from space and as seen from Earth. And with that comes a number of alarming effects that we are only beginning to understand the full extent of today. And these range from the ways in which artificial light affects our ability to do science and astronomy and learn about the universe beyond, to ecological impacts associated with the way light disrupts habitat, all the way down the line to the way in which artificial light might be affecting humans physiologically by disrupting our circadian rhythms. You're right when you suggest that light pollution has not been immediately on everybody's radar screen in the past. And I think the role of our film, The City Dark, is to try and introduce people to the idea that we might be overlighting our world, and in the process, losing not only all that we gain as scientists and all that we gain as healthy individuals from a natural light-dark cycle, but also we might be losing something a little more hard to pin down, our connection to the stars and to the night sky. And that's what the film begins to explore.
How much research is actually out there on this topic? And how much material did you have to work with?
Well, the film is about 80 minutes long in its feature-length form. But we filmed probably 250 to 300 hours of footage of scientists and writers and thinkers and doctors and chronobiologists all around the country and to a limited extent all around the world. And there's an amazing wealth of information, much of it available through an organization called the International Dark Sky Association, darksky.org, that is collecting a lot of the research associated with the way we light our world and disrupt our darkness and making it available to the public. So while much of the research, for example, research associated with circadian rhythms and how humans might be at risk of developing certain cancers as a result of disrupted light-dark cycle, While much of that research is very much evolving and somewhat young, there is enormous interest in this topic across all disciplines.
Now, the documentary is divided into six chapters. There's loss of night sky, there's the effects on nature, night shifts, why we light, and astrophilia. And I think I missed one. How easy or difficult was it to compartmentalize all the information you had in these six categories?
The film does unfold in these chapters, and it is therefore somewhat essay-like in its form as we move roughly from one topic to the next. But narratively, it's very much a journey, and it chronicles my journey as a filmmaker, learning more and more about this topic. So we do set out from New York City early on in the film to find out the implications of spreading artificial light, and that's what brings us to all corners of the globe, really, in exploring this issue. And the threads that I think connect all of these chapters are these twin questions of how does light pollution affect our world in a physical way, in a physiological way, in a way that we can measure, in a way that we can understand as scientists, And then also, how does light pollution and the loss of the night sky and the loss of our connection to the universe affect us more psychologically, more spiritually, more culturally? What do we lose as a people when we don't see how big the universe really is? And those questions connect all of these six disparate chapters that chronicle our journey to understand light at night.
Now, two of my favorite parts in the documentary were, one was where you talk to this man who has a collection, who runs a shop of light bulbs, and he actually has two or three bulbs that Edison made.
Yeah, we visited a fellow who runs a fascinating light bulb, kind of specialty light bulb supply store in Hackensack, New Jersey, and he pulled out of a dusty drawer these beautiful old bulbs from the time of Thomas Edison. I think one of them was an original Edison light bulb. And when he plugged that light bulb in, it still worked. It still glowed. That warm glow, I mean, for me, helps explain why we've become so enamored with light. It's so beautiful, and there's so much you can do with it, and it's so inviting. You know, it probably has roots in our love of the campfire or something.
Another favorite part of mine was when the Florida beach turtles, how they get disoriented, and instead of moving toward the ocean, they move toward city lights. Which were your favorite parts of the documentary?
Well, it's hard to pick a favorite in a film like this. I must say, I will say I really enjoyed spending time with astronomers and astrophysicists who are trying to peer very deeply into outer space, because on the one hand, they were very comfortable talking about these unbelievably complex ideas, frontiers of astrophysics, like dark matter, dark energy. I mean, they're exploring the very stuff of the universe, the hidden matter that drives everything around us. And on the other hand, they're most of the scientists I spoke to were also very willing to try and explain in less technical terms what the stars mean to them and why they're so fascinated with exploring outer space. And it's actually something that a lot of us have a hard time putting into words. And that's something I've seen in the distribution of the film as we've been pushing it out from film festivals through our theatrical premiere in New York and soon on public television this summer on PBS's show POV, is that when we share the film with folks, we often hear a lot of responses about when people first saw the Milky Way, you know, when they first stepped outside of a city and saw our galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars, and try to articulate what that means and how we value that. I think that challenge to express how we value something like the stars is very central to this issue, and it's very similar to how we talk about nature and how we value the environment. How do you put a price tag on a walk on the beach or a hike in the mountains? I think it's similar with the night sky.
You also talked about the importance of light and how that has been used in cultures throughout the world. Was the ambivalence deliberate, or, you know, something that was just a consequence of putting these all parts of the puzzle together?
I think the ambivalence I've felt and still feel is very honest, and I think it's something that some level took me by surprise after working on the film for a few years, was my own realization of how much I came to love the sight of the city skyline and love living in the city. And part of that is the way it looks and it being able to go out at night and feel like you're in a vibrant environment where you can see your way and feel safe and gain everything that we gain from lighting our world. So I came to feel, though, that we can have that, but we can also not waste so much money and so much energy and disrupt so many ecosystems and disrupt our own circadian rhythms with light trespassing into our bedroom windows, and maybe even bring back some more stars to the night sky. But I also think we need to pay attention to the fact that so many young people are now growing up in urban environments. And while we should make great efforts to truck them out to the wilderness, I think there's also something to be gained from bringing back more stars to our city skies.
Now, for me, the documentary not only raises some practical questions, but also some philosophical questions about my place in this universe. What questions do you want your viewers to ask after they've watched the documentary?
I hope that viewers see the film and remember to look up more, no matter where they live. I think that's something that we can forget to do when there's not too much to see when you look up. But I think the more we look up, maybe the more we'll notice that we can retool our lights, and that they're not built appropriately. And then hopefully the more we look up, we can remember that we are on a planet in a great big universe, and that that perspective is really valuable. And I hope that viewers ask themselves, what does that perspective mean and where does it leave us? You know, this idea that we are on a very unique water-covered planet in a pretty big universe that is mostly cold, empty space. And what does that tell us about how we should steward this place and what we should do with our time on it?
The City Dark will be screened next Monday at 5:30 p.m. inside Verizon Ballroom in the University of Arkansas Union. The screening is a part of a new series launched by the UV Honors College called Honors College Invites, which hopes to bring scholars and experts to the region to benefit the community. And since we're talking about the night sky and space, today's question is also related to it. Toward the end of the 1950s, the Soviet Union was preparing to send a dog into orbit above Earth to test the space environment for living beings. The Soviets used 9 so-called space dogs to test spacesuits in the unpressurized cabins of spaceflight capsules, and then in 1957, the first dog was launched into space. Can you give me the name of that first dog that was launched into space? Call us at 1-800-522-5823. That's 1-800-522-KUAF to win a pair of tickets to Symphony of Northwest Arkansas's next concert and a couple of Malco movie passes.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 5th of March, 2012. It was on this day, 1933, the Nazi Party in Germany won 44% of the vote in parliamentary elections, which enabled it to join with the nationalists to gain a slight majority in the Reichstag. And within 3 weeks, the Reichstag had passed the Enabling Act, which gave Hitler dictatorial powers. It was on this day in 1975 that the Homebrew Computer Club first met in a garage near Menlo Park in Silicon Valley. 1975, computers were not for personal use. They were gigantic, could take up an entire room, could cost about $1 million apiece. Among the early members of the Homebrew Computer Club were high school friends Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who designed the Apple I and the Apple II to bring down to the Homebrew Computer Club and show it off. It's the birthday of the novelist Frank Norris, Chicago, 1870, author of McTeague, died at 32 of a ruptured appendix, having written 2 books of his Epic of Wheat trilogy, The Octopus and The Pit. Frank Norris, who said, "I never truckled, I never took off the hat to fashion and held it out for pennies. By God, I told them the truth. They liked it or they didn't like it." It's the birthday of the novelist Leslie Marmon Silco, born Albuquerque, 1948, grew up in the Laguna Pueblo Reservation, went to law school, but she quit after she read Charles Dickens's Bleak House. She said, "The law has nothing to do with justice, and injustice can't be left unchallenged. So I decided to be a writer. Writing can't change the world overnight, but writing may have an enormous effect over time, over the long haul. Best known for her novel Ceremony, story of a Laguna man named Tayo, who comes home to the reservation after surviving World War II and the Bataan Death March. And it's the anniversary of the shooting incident that came to be called the Boston Massacre 1770, an argument between colonials and a British soldier. A crowd of men gathered, soldiers came out on the street, the crowd taunted them, threw ice at them, dared them to shoot, and they did, and five men were killed. The soldiers were put on trial. The lawyer chosen to represent them was John Adams, who managed to get all but two acquitted. Here's a poem for today by Lucy Shaw, entitled Revival. March, I'm beginning to anticipate a thaw. Early mornings, the earth, old unbeliever, is still crusted with frost where the moles have nosed up their cold castings, and the ground cover in shadow under the cedars hasn't softened for months. Fogs layering their slow, complicated ice around foliage and stem night by night. But as the light lengthens, preacher of good news, evangelizing leaves and branches, his large gestures beckon green out of gray. Pinpricks of coral bursting from the cotoneasters, a single bee finding the white heather, eager lemon-yellow aconites glowing low to the ground like little uplifted faces, a crocus shooting up a purple hand here, there, as I stand on my doorstep, my own face drinking in heat and light like a bud welcoming resurrection, and my hand up too, ready to sign on for conversion. Revival, a poem by Lucy Shaw from What the Light Was Like, published by Word Farm and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
So my question for today was, name the first dog that was sent into space. The correct answer is Laika, L-A-I-K-A. Laika was a mongrel dog captured from a Moscow street. She was launched into space on November 3rd, 1957. If your answer is correct, your name has been put into the ceramic cow and we'll pick a winner soon. Support for KUAF comes from Carmike 14 Cinema in Fort Smith and Ballet in Cinema, featuring Le Corsair, live from the Bolshoi on Sunday, March 11th with an encore performance on Tuesday, March 20th. Tickets and more information are available on the web at carmike.com. Support also comes from SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, continuing its inaugural season on Saturday, March 10th at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. SONA and the Fayetteville Jazz Collective will present 250 years of greatest hits, a program of classical and jazz genres interwoven into a continuous musical fabric by acclaimed musicians and director Paul Haas. 443-5600 or waltonartcenter.org for tickets or more information. This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhulkar. Thanks for listening and have a great week.